From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I talk with Gloria Steinem. In the 15 years since she co-founded Ms. Magazine, Steinem has been at the forefront of the feminist movement. Also today, jazz pianist and singer Bob Dureau sits down at the piano to play some of his best-known songs like I'm Hip and Blue Christmas, which he wrote for Miles Davis. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Peter Sellers' new production of Mozart's Don Giovanni, and language commentator and linguist Jeffrey Nunberg explains exactly what linguists do for a living. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Gloria Steinem. Over the past 15 years, she's become a symbol of the women's movement. She's perhaps best known as the editor of Ms. Magazine, which she co-founded in 1972. In commemoration of its 15th anniversary, the editors of Ms. have put together a special double issue and a new book titled Letters to Ms. 1972 to 1987, for which Steinem wrote the introduction. In addition to her work as a journalist and editor, Gloria Steinem is a political activist. She co-founded the National Women's Political Caucus and Voters for Choice, a nonpartisan political action committee that supports pro-choice candidates. She's also active with various peace and disarmament groups. Steinem is the author of two recent books. One is an anthology of her essays titled Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions. Her most recent book is Marilyn, Norma Jean, which is a feminist analysis of sex symbol Marilyn Monroe. Gloria Steinem, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Since Ms. is celebrating its 15th anniversary, why don't we start by looking back a little bit at the history of that magazine. You had already worked for several magazines as a journalist. Why did you think it was important to have a magazine written by and devoted to women?
Well, first, because even before I began to think about anything that might be called feminism or to question the structures that women encountered, I and lots of women could not write about political subjects for the existing magazines. We were thought to be the experts on, food, makeup, babies, and celebrities, but that was pretty much it. And though I railed against it, as many other women did, perhaps not hard enough in retrospect, but at least we tried, it really didn't budge very much. Then after we began to realize that there was a reason why women felt connected to other discriminated against groups and kind of identified with the underdog, because we were also underdogs, and there began to be a women's movement. Then the magazine said, well, you know, we published our article on feminism last year, or if we're going to write one article saying that women are full human beings, we'll have to publish one right next to it saying they're not in order to be objective. So it became more and more clear to lots of us that we could not either write what we wanted to or read or edit what we wanted to in the existing magazines. So we started to meet and discuss whether or not, you know, a magazine might be possible.
Did you find, too, that a lot of male editors thought that it was just too specialized, too narrow to write about issues like abortion or equality for women? Yeah, because all of their readers wouldn't be interested in it.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And that was true on the left and on the right. You know, you would find, I'm sorry to say, is because I have much more affection for the left, but you would find left men editors who would say, well, you know, abortion is too controversial and we can't divide the left, quote unquote, with this kind of argument. Of course, it was actually much more popular as an issue than anything they were talking about. But still, you know, that just wasn't it just wasn't serious in their view. There is still some of this going on, you know, absolutely. I mean, women are still viewed as a single issue, whereas men are the world. But it's greatly diminished. And I when I think about the life of the magazine, I think partly about the fact that everybody said after the first issue, well, they've said everything they have to say. What is there to talk about besides childcare and welfare is a woman's issue and, you know, a few other things? But that's it. You know, now what? I mean, so actually the movement and the magazine has been being pronounced over. ever since the first story that I know of, that the cover story pronouncing the Women's Movement over, was from 1969, before the magazine ever started.
Well, that was pretty premature.
Right.
What did you think the state of feminist coverage was in the mainstream media in the early 70s and late 60s?
It was mostly ridicule, really, because that was the era of, quote, bra burners, unquote, an alliterative epithet invented by a guy from the New York Post who was actually covering the demonstration against the Miss America contest. And though nobody ever burned anything, although they did threaten to burn, I don't know, a steno pad, a dust mop, an apron. They put all this stuff in a dustbin on the boardwalk. They were going to burn it, including a bra. But they never did because they couldn't get a fire permit. I mean, this is, you know, we're just much too docile, right? But nonetheless, he picked up. He couldn't resist the alliteration. And that was symbolic of the kind of ridicule, really. So to move forward to serious opposition is ironically a step forward.
I think that women's organizations and publications functioned on two levels, especially at the beginning. One was that the content was going to be oriented toward women, and the other was this kind of utopian sense that with women at the controls, it was going to have a different structure, a different sense of power and hierarchy than their male-run counterparts had. Did that happen at Ms. Magazine? Did you have a sense of, you know, what the utopian women's mm-hmm. run magazine was going to be like? And I'm talking about
the
power structure.
We did, but it wasn't totally, it was somewhat wrong, but not totally wrong. For instance, when we started out, I mean, an example of our naivete was that we sat around, there were eight of us, and we sat around and we fixed each other's salaries, basically. Well, first, no, the real utopian thing was that we thought we should all have the same salary. But it soon became clear to us, just knowing each other's lives, that was not possible. Some of us were supporting children and some were not. Some, you know, were older and had been earning, you know, higher salaries in the past. So we did fix each other's salaries, but we took three things in mind. One, what our need was. Two, what our experience was. And three, how important we were to the life of the magazine itself. What we did do, though, was to try to and something we've still maintained, to make sure that the top salary was no more than three times the lowest salary. So, you know, I think in a way that's a little microcosm of the both the idealism and the realism. That is, okay, no, we couldn't all earn the same salary, but yes, we could substantially change the way money was distributed so that the top was three times the bottom, which is very different from other magazines where the chief editor may earn, you know, $200,000 or more, and the secretary earns 10. You know, I mean, at least we narrowed the gap a lot.
Have you maintained any of those initial utopian ideals?
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, I think that's very practical. We have maintained the kind of 3-to-1 ratio. And it is practical, and it does help. I mean, it doesn't make sense to make that much of a differentiation, I think, among people who are all contributing to the same thing. And we also, though the original, I'm sure, vision of us was all sitting around cross-legged on the floor voting on everything, which we could never do, of course. You know, you can't, every person can't read every manuscript and vote on it. It's just not possible. However, we have maintained a different kind of structure because, I mean, if you come to one of our editorial meetings, it's just real different from anybody else's editorial meeting because in the other ones, I mean, I've worked for practically every other women's magazine or any magazine, I think, in some time in my life, and their editorial meetings are always everybody looks at one person, you know, at the chief editor to see, can I intrigue him or her? Am I pleasing him or her? Am I, you know? Our meetings are not like that. The people are looking at and trying to persuade either the most resistant person or the person who knows the most about this subject matter. Whatever it is, it's quite different. And I think it's very important because instead of replicating the limitations as well as the virtues of one person, you have a chance to have the collective wisdom and strengths of the whole group.
My guest is Gloria Steinem, who is the founding editor of Ms. Magazine. Did you go through this phenomenon that when you formed this magazine with other women, that male colleagues of yours, male journalists, assumed that what you did all day was sit around and talk about men, complain bitterly about men?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I hadn't thought about that in a long time, but you're completely right. I remember somebody saying to me at one of the networks, CBS, I think, that whenever three or four women had lunch together, that it made all the men nervous because they thought we were, you know, planning, midnight castration parties or something. I don't know why. And I think that's true. You know, it's so threatening, oddly threatening, for a few women to be together. I do think that that's diminished a lot.
Do you think that your mission has changed in the 15 years that you've been editing Ms?
I think so. I mean, well, the overall mission is still to be a forum for the ideas of equality and how to get there, and for the fiction and poetry and, you know, all of the kind of creative, we do need art and poetry and everything, you know, if this is really going to be a full revolution. But the form that overall purpose takes has changed, because in the beginning, we spent an awful lot of time proving that there was discrimination. I mean, it was really the popular notion that white women controlled the economy, that widows, you know, inherited, all kinds of power and wealth, and that black women were matriarchs, thanks to Patrick Moynihan. So we did spend an inordinate amount of time doing big, big survey pieces. You know, what is it like to be a woman on welfare? What is it really like to be a woman on Wall Street? What is it really like to be a flight attendant? We had to prove that there was discrimination. And we had to either name ourselves or report on those women who were naming problems that had had no name: battered women, displaced homemaker, sexual harassment, so many things that had just had no names. They were just called life, you know, they were just thought to be normal. Changing rape to sexual assault, making clear that rape was not about sex, it was about violence. Differentiating between pornography and erotica, which of course is still not nearly done, you know. It was a process of proving what already existed and naming. I think now it's much more diverse and, I find, exciting editorially, because it's not so much reaction as action. That is, we're more likely to be able to, instead of reacting to the discriminatory forces of society, report on initiatives that women are taking to live a different way. Maybe that's women starting their own businesses. Maybe it's women reorganizing the way the work is done in the home and trying to get it shared equally. Maybe it's women visual artists who have a whole different symbolic vocabulary. But whatever it is, it's a little bit more likely. I mean, I don't want to be overly optimistic here, but a little bit more likely to be moving forward instead of simply responding.
We're looking back at 15 years ago when you started Ms. Magazine, and I know you think many things have changed for the better since then, but I also know that you think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. You have an essay in the anniversary issue that opens with an anecdote where you describe a business friend of yours saying to you, "Well, you must be really happy the women's movement is over, and now you can move on to other things." And I think that that's a fairly commonly held attitude, mm-hmm. that we're in the post-feminist era, the era. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the New York Times has given us this term, post-feminist. Thank you very much.
Well, do you think that that feminism has done its job already, that equal rights have been won and now it's on to other things?
No, certainly not. And since, just today or this week has been released a study of the status of American women now, financed by the Ford Foundation and done by the Congressional Women's Caucus, which shows that a college-educated woman working full-time still makes less than a male high school dropout working full-time. I mean, you know, we certainly have every kind of dramatic illustration before us that what we have done is to advance the dreams and the possibilities and the idea that women are full human beings, which is a first in history, perhaps, since our subordinate role was thought to be natural before. But we have not clearly not changed the structures, in fact. And we really, in a literal sense, have if not just begun, I mean, we're still in the first quarter or third of this wave.
Do you think that in some ways, talking about how well feminism has done its work, equal rights have been won, that that kind of stand is a justification of maintaining the status quo?
Mm-hmm. Like, oh, yeah,
well,
absolutely.
The battle's over, and now we can just go back and
it's just
do things as they've been.
It's just a different form of resistance, because in the beginning it was, as it is with all movements, that this movement is not necessary. You know, my maid doesn't like these Black Panthers. You know, my wife doesn't care about feminism. You know, she, and then after it turns out to be necessary, or at least, I mean, to be happening anyway, then the next move is to say, well, it's over. I mean, it used to be necessary, but it's not anymore. And I think we just have to expect that. In the 10th anniversary issue of the magazine, perhaps we should have done this again, I don't know, we did a no-comment spread. That's the kind of section of the magazine which we put things that are so bad they need no comment. Of all of the, or some of the cover stories and headlines and so on, declaring that the women's movement was dead, and the first one was in 1969. So this has been going on for a very long time. Now, the man that you describe, and that, you know, who is not a friend actually, but, you know, a fairly typical
a consultant.
Acquaintance, yeah. I said to him, well, you know, what makes you think the women's movement is over? Well, I see women everywhere, he said. I see them in my bank, my office, my... And I thought of saying to him that after all, these women were not... They were all working for him or at lower levels. They weren't at his own level, and certainly he was not working for a woman. But I thought maybe that didn't go far enough, because he would just say, well, when women have been in the pipeline far, you know, that, you know, they just haven't been around long enough. So I said, well, do you see men raising children as much as women do, or, you know, doing the work of homemaking and so on as much as women do? Certainly not, he said, you know, shocked. You know, that will never happen. Is that what you want? You know, so I think we just need to advance our dreams and make the future vision, I don't mean as some kind of airtight utopia, but just future possibilities, let's put it that way, clear. And then we understand, we both release hopes in ourselves and we give ourselves a much better, more realistic idea of exactly where we are and the overall progress.
Gloria Steinem is my guest, and we're going to talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Gloria Steinem is my guest. She's the founding editor of Ms. Magazine, which is celebrating its 15th anniversary this month. And in celebration of it, it has a special double issue and also a new book of letters titled Letters to Ms. 1972 to 1987. Now, one of the big women's related issues in the news now is the possible campaign of Pat Schroeder for the presidency. And I wonder how important the issue of a woman president is to you. And here's why I'm asking it. We've seen Margaret Thatcher be a head of state, and I don't believe she's been an activist campaigner for women's rights. Now, Pat Schroeder probably would be. But, I mean, you can't in politics necessarily equate being a woman with being a feminist and campaigning on the rights for the rights of women.
No, certainly not. I mean, there will always be people who look like us and behave like them. And in some ways, that's even more confusing. I mean, clearly there are Black opponents of affirmative action, and there are women who oppose equality. And, you know, it's not by any means the majority. It's a small group, but it's inevitable. And it's somewhat inevitable that those folks may be chosen by the opposition first. But I do think that this country is in a slightly different situation from England, say, or from India, thinking of Indira Gandhi as the other most famous chief of state, because they have a stronger caste or class system than we do. I'm not saying we don't have one. We do, but not quite of the same depth. And therefore, the caste or class of a woman may mitigate the disaster of her being female. In other words, if Indira Gandhi had had a brother, she never would have been the prime minister. But since she didn't have a brother, her family was so important and the legacy of Pandit Nehru was so important that even the disaster of being a female was somewhat diminished. Similarly with Thatcher, she didn't stand for the majority hopes of women as a group. She stood for a class interest, basically. So that class interest mitigated the disaster of being a female, and she was elected. So you're more likely, excuse me.
Why don't you take a sip of water?
Okay.
I'll reintroduce you. My guest is feminist Gloria Steinem, who's a founding editor of Ms. Magazine and one of the leading feminist activists in America. And
Thank you. We're
talking about women in politics.
So anyway, what happens in those countries is you're more likely to get a single woman in a top leadership position first. In this country, it takes longer by a lot, but you're somewhat more likely to get someone who actually represents the majority hopes of that particular group, at least in the second wave, if not in the first wave of leadership. Even having said that, however, it's important to remember that unless there's an organized constituency, nobody in the leadership position can do a whole lot because they will be pressured by the same forces that pressure the people already there. But I do think that, as Jesse Jackson has often pointed out, that the candidacies of, for instance, Shirley Chisholm as the first black and woman running for the presidency, Jesse himself, Geraldine Ferraro, and now Patricia Schroeder, have taken the white male-only sign off the White House in our minds, and that is the first step, and have also introduced new issues into the public forum that would not be there otherwise. I mean, Pat Schroeder, I hope very much, decides to make the run. She's basing the decision on whether she can collect enough money to really make an effective run, because just her presence in the debates will make an enormous difference. She is much more expert than anybody else there on military and foreign policy questions. She's been on the Armed Services Committee for 14, 15 years, and of course on the issues of sexual equality is the same. And Jesse Jackson's presence in those debates makes an enormous difference too.
One of the early sayings in the women's movement was "the personal is political," and I wonder if that still has the same resonance for you now that it did in the late 60s.
It really does. I think in some ways we're only, you know how you learn something intellectually before it gets to you emotionally sometimes? Mm-hmm. I think it's just getting to us emotionally now.
How is it getting to you emotionally now?
Well, I guess, I mean, this may sound strange, but I'm just beginning to realize that I need to do some of the things that I have been saying should be done. In other words, I've been telling women, for instance, or trying to help women editorially know how to manage their money, to save money. Have I done this up to now? No, absolutely not. I mean, at no point have I had enough money to last more than a month or two, I don't think, because I was just having a much better time giving it away. But also, which is, I think, a positive reason, but also just because I didn't feel comfortable exerting that kind of control over money. I hadn't internalized the message myself. And I'm just beginning to try to do that. And there are all kinds of examples.
What's another one?
Well, just my own apartment. I mean, I've lived in the same apartment since 1962, so it's the very same two rooms. I turned it into a closet, basically, because once the movement was born, I was traveling so much. And I really didn't make a place for myself that was pleasant or supportive. And I realize in retrospect that I was kind of replicating my childhood. I happened to have lived a very chaotic, I mean, it wasn't my parents' fault. They did the best they could. But, it was a kind of neglected, chaotic childhood. And I guess because it feels like home, because it's the only thing we have known, then we replicate it. Maybe it's what we want, but maybe it isn't. We have to realize that we can make a choice. And I'm just beginning to do that. So I think in a funny way, and I see this with other women too, perhaps especially with women who are married and have children, who were out there on the hustings, you know, campaigning and doing a lot of very valuable work, but hadn't changed the structures inside their own houses because that was harder, you know, in terms of their husbands and, you know, what was really going on. So in a funny way, is some Corinne Horrible, who's a wonderful feminist in Minneapolis, who is married and does have children, she said to me, you know, we knew that the personal was political, but now I'm just learning that the political is personal.
Your grandmother was a suffragist and a delegate to a big international convention back in 1908. I wonder if that had any effect on you at all, because I should point out she's on your father's side, and I believe he left your mother and you when you were pretty young. So was there any feminist legacy passed on from her through the
family?
No,
there really wasn't, and I feel bad about that because it caused my mother to lead a less strong life than she might have otherwise, and because it caused me to waste a lot of time rediscovering the wheel, but also because it means that our lessons of today can be forgotten too. My grandmother, after the vote was achieved, stopped being active in the way that you know many suffragists did, out of exhaustion, out of lack of self-respect, out of, you know, I don't know why, but she did. So by the time I was born, she was not active, and since she died when I was very little, I never knew, really. And my family kind of inadvertently concealed what she had been up to. I mean, they would tell me how she was a wonderful woman because she founded the first vocational high school in Toledo. She raised four sons, and she kept a kosher table and so on. But they didn't tell me that she was this, you know, kind of raging feminist who marched in the streets and ran for the school board on a coalition ticket with the anarchists and the socialists. They sort of conveniently forgot that part.
Were they embarrassed by it?
I don't know. It wasn't conscious on their parts exactly, but it was. I think it just wasn't socially good to have done this. So they didn't exactly conceal it, but they didn't talk about it. So it wasn't until a nice feminist in Toledo wrote a monograph about my grandmother and sent it to me that I had any idea of the scope of her activities.
You said that this worried you in a way because it meant that other families or other women can forget what happened before. Is that what you're afraid mm-hmm. is happening in the, quote, post-feminist period?
No, I don't think. I mean, that only began to happen after a century. And we're only, you know, 25 years or so into this, and it is not post-feminist, no matter what the New York Times says. It's just that young women, if the young women have a problem, it's only that they think there's no problem. And, of course, they will, you know, get educated by the world and by you know, what they meet in the labor force and when they have children and so on.
Gloria Steinem, I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for visiting with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been feminist Gloria Steinem, who is a founder and editor of Ms. Magazine, which is celebrating its 15th anniversary this summer. The magazine has put together a collection of letters titled Letters to Ms. 1972-87, published by Henry Holt. There's also a special anniversary edition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with novelist John Barth, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, jazz pianist and singer Bob Dureau joins us at the piano to play his musical autobiography. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new production of Mozart's Don Giovanni, staged by Peter Sellers. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg answers the question, what do linguists really do? That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Last week, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz went to see director Peter Sellers' latest opera production at PepsiCo's Summer Fair in Purchase, New York. Sellers is known for his ambitious debuts and his often controversial, updated interpretations of theater classics and opera. This time, he and conductor Craig Smith have taken on Mozart's Don Giovanni, the story of a womanizing young nobleman.
1987 marks the bicentennial not only of the American Constitution, but of another more ambiguous statement about liberty, Mozart's Don Giovanni. Viva la libertà, Mozart's revolutionary Don Juan makes everyone repeat at his wild party. Probably no one has ever taken more liberties with our preconceptions of this opera than Peter Sellers, the young American director who, with his collaborator, conductor Craig Smith, has been changing the face of 20th century opera production. Don Giovanni at PepsiCo Summer Fair is their latest adventure. Sellers worked on Don Giovanni once before, 7 years ago. It was his first complete professional opera, and like all his later work, it was both controversial and a knockout. His most notorious image for life in the fast lane was a Big Mac at Don Giovanni's elegant Last Supper. The contemporary updating demystified the supernatural ending, turning heavenly retribution into a practical joke on the Don perpetrated by his victims. But Sellers has deepened his ability to mix styles and blend the realistic with the visionary. The Big Mac is still there, now joined by Chicken McNuggets, and so is the sinister practical joke, the handguns and hypodermic needles. But he also brings back Mozart's apocalyptic, supernatural ending, and with overwhelming theatrical and moral power. The new setting, brilliantly designed by George Zippin, is a street corner in Spanish Harlem, the intersection of, say, 117th Street and the 7th Circle of Hell. There are burning trash cans, a church with a white neon cross, corrugated metal storefronts, a gaping excavation with blinking warning lights, and a three-story tenement with windows that light up and open like an advent calendar designed by Hieronymus Bosch. The lighting by James F. Ingalls works like cross-cutting in a movie, a brilliant solution to Mozart's cinematic scene shifting. It both dazzles and keeps us in the dark. Sometimes you can barely make out what's going on. This is a dangerous night world. There are no rules, and life is cheap. Don Giovanni here is a free-spending, sex-obsessed drug dealer, young but already burnt out. Not the least perverse of Sellers' ideas is that the notorious libertine is almost completely passive. He makes women run after him, and he's especially fond of little girls. Here's Kurt Allman elegantly singing the famous serenade. The noise in the middle isn't a set change, but Don Giovanni falling off his chair when a mysterious little girl suddenly appears in a second-story window, the same girl who'll rematerialize at the end of the opera and pull him down headfirst through an open manhole into hell.
Oh, yeah.
Sellers consistently avoids class distinctions. Leporello is more the Don's henchman than his servant. Donna Anna is not an aristocrat, but a heroin addict who's been having a secret affair with Don Giovanni. Not all of this works, and some of the casting is weak. But Lorraine Hunt as Elvira, who looks like Madonna and sounds like a major new opera star, gives a devastating, no-holds-barred performance as the woman wronged who still wants to save her lover's soul. Janet Brown as Zerlina is heartbreaking in the fragile beauty of her voice and demeanor, especially in her soothingly sexual wedding night reconciliation aria. And Jose Garcia is extraordinary as both her exuberantly demonstrative husband, loving yet violent, and the imposing commendatore who returns as a ghostly statue. Craig Smith's conducting is magnificent, spacious like Klemperer, and full of ironic contrasts. He builds the whole opera inevitably and enthrallingly to its shattering conclusion. What's most extraordinary about this production is that in spite of all its ideas, maybe too many for its own good, its vision is basically instinctual. It reaches you on a profoundly emotional level. I've never seen a Don Giovanni that comes to grips so fully with the vision of hell and the hell we make of our lives that Mozart created in his sublime and dangerous music.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Don Giovanni will be in repertory with the first of the Sellers-Smith-Mozart collaborations, Così fan tutte, at PepsiCo's Summer Fair through August 2nd. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is singer, songwriter, and pianist Bob Dureau. He came to New York in the early 1950s to be close to the music of Charlie Parker, but his own music changed course. While most of the boppers were blowing chord changes, Dureau was writing and singing songs. Dureau became one of the few singers tapped by Miles Davis to write and perform with him. Over the years, Dureau has written many songs with lyricist Fran Lansman. She's best known for her song Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most. In the 70s, Dureau wrote such tunes as Multiplication Rock and My Hero Zero for a Saturday morning kids' TV show called Schoolhouse Rock. His best-known song, I'm Hip, has become a standard among jazz musicians and singers. When Bob Dureau visited the Fresh Air Studios, he sat down at the piano, and I asked him to sing a little from his biggest hit.
It's a hit? Gee, I've been hoping it'd be a hit. I've been waiting in the alley for the royalty checks to come. You must know, of course, that I wrote it with Dave Frischberg. It's our only collaboration. Well, Blossom recorded it, and he and I recorded it. Mel Torme recorded. Who's next? Let's make this a real hit. Ascavadava. I need it. Well, I'm hip. I'm no square. I'm alert. I'm awake. I'm aware. I am always on the scene, making the rounds, digging those sounds. I read People magazine. Well, no, I don't think I read People. I read some of those hip magazines, you know what I mean? Because I'm hip. What's the latest thing? Should I be reading New Yorker or something?
The word used to be Playboy magazine in the original song,
yeah.
Right? Did you always know a lot of hipsters yourself? Did you ever think of yourself as a hipster?
No, I was an observer. I had a lot of really hip friends. But I'm just playing the part in the song, really.
I've always loved your singing, and I think that your voice doesn't fit into any of the kind of standard categories in jazz or pop singing. You know, in jazz you have the blues shouters with the really big voice, and then you have the ballad singers, someone between a Sinatra or an Eckstein. And your voice, I think, is pretty uncategorizable.
Well, thank you so much.
How did you find your voice? I mean, how did you develop your own singing style?
Well, I think it happened in my student days when I was studying jazz, and when I realized that a lot of the jazz men weren't known as singers, but they did sing. Maybe they did it to help the band get the job, I'm not sure, but way back to all those guys like Lionel Hampton and Trummy Young and, of course, Louis Armstrong, Jack T. Garden. You know, they would sing a song during the night, and I thought, gee, that's great, I can sing too. Nothing against it, and I started singing. And I was influenced by Nat King Cole and Joe Mooney and a lot of the more modern people.
At the time you were coming of age in the 1950s, it was a period when a lot of jazz musicians were playing bebop, and there was very little singing that went along with that.
I always had a sort of a squelch on me. You know, I didn't want to be corny and sing, but I loved singing, so I would practice in my own room. But when I went out with the cats, we'd blow bebop, and I was a bebop student in New York City.
So it was considered a little square to sing?
Yeah, I guess it was.
You had mentioned that a lot of the bop musicians didn't really go for singing, but I know that Miles Davis actually asked you to write a song for an album he was doing of Christmas songs.
Yes, he was to take part in the Columbia Jingle Bell Jazz album. Each Columbia artist or some of them were doing Christmas songs.
Did he say what he liked about your singing?
Well, he had already dug my first LP and he liked my singing, so he called me suddenly one day and actually, his attorney did most of the talking, but he said, I want you to write me a Christmas song and sing it. And so I wrote a sort of a blue Christmas, thinking about the other side of it, you know.
Can you play a few bars of the song you wrote for him?
Oh, yeah, here's the line that might go down. Lots of hungry homeless children in your own backyard, while you're very, very busy addressing 20 zillion Christmas cards. Now Yuletide is the season to receive and ought to give, but all you December do-gooders rush around and loudly rant and rave. Merry Christmas, I hope you have a bright one, but for me it's blue.
And what happened with the song? You recorded it for him?
We recorded it with his band, and it came out on that particular album, and I guess it's been reissued on other albums.
One of the things that you started doing in the 1950s, I think, was writing lyrics to solo jazz improvisation lines that, say, Charlie Parker had played on record. How did you get exposed to that idea?
I was inspired to that end by Annie Ross and Eddie Jefferson and King Pleasure. They were doing those things, and especially Annie Ross did the Twisted, and I thought, oh, she's so clever, and it's funny, and it can be funny. But I started tinkering around with some of the jazz recordings. You take a jazz recording and put lyrics, a syllable to every note, if you can. And when Bird died, I decided to write a sort of a story of Charlie Parker to the Yardbird Suite. And that was my first effort.
Did you do a couple of bars of that?
Oh, yeah. I put my own intro to it to get your attention. Hey, jazz fans, I'm talking to you. I sing this song hoping you'll all find out the man who wrote the Yardbird Suite. Leave you no doubt and tell you about. That's 8 bars plus intro. Is that enough?
Yeah. You were saying earlier that a lot of jazz musicians thought it was kind of square to sing. But if you were singing to a Parker tune, was it different? Was that more acceptable?
Definitely different. That was a new kind of hip singing.
Your fans include not only jazz listeners, but also a lot of children who know your music from the Schoolhouse Rock series on television, and you even had an album out a few years ago called Multiplication Rock.
Oh, yeah, that was a great opportunity, a commission to write songs for kids. And at that time, I wasn't really doing much club work. I figured the adults don't want to hear me. They're listening to rock and roll, so I'll do something for the kids, and it was a wonderful opportunity, and now they come into the nightclub, you know, they're 25 or even 29, and they want to hear some of those kids' songs, and so, I do them right there in the nightclub.
So they remember you from the series.
Yes.
Can you do a few bars of one of the songs for us?
Oh, yeah. Well, I always thought of this as my theme song. It's the Lucky Rabbit Who Likes to Sing and Dance. Well, you can call me Lucky, 'cause Lucky's my name. Singing and dancing, that's my game. I never did a whole day's work in my life. Still, everything seemed to turn out right. Like a grasshopper on a summer day, I just loved to play and pass the time away. 'Cause I was born 'neath a lucky star. They said I'd come far. Here I am, on NPR.
A lot of people probably would feel funny writing songs for children. Was it hard or was it different?
It was different. Well, I'd always wanted to play and sing for children, and I've always dug them, you know. I like little people. And I was the Uncle Bobby in a lot of my friends who had children long before I did, and of course I had my own. When I started this series, my daughter was just at the right age for that kind of thing, multiplication, sixth grade or less, third, fourth, fifth grade. So it was, like I say, a great opportunity, and I really loved it. And I played in a lot of schools in Manhattan just to see if they were digging me on TV. Suddenly I was a star, you know.
You've been recording on your own record label, and you distribute your records yourself, and I think you have a whole network of listeners around the country who you mm-hmm. can even send cards to when you know you're going to be performing in their part of town. And I think that you have a certain commitment on the part of your listeners because you're so unique mm-hmm. and also because it's hard to find you sometimes.
Yeah, a lot of them have stuck with me through thick and thin, and I must give credit to the great radio stations around the country who've kept me alive, even when I wasn't there in person.
But even today when you came to our radio station, you met up with one of your listeners on the way here. And I know you've done that in the past. When you go to a city, you tend to call up the people who've corresponded with you in the past.
I like to give back when I can, yeah.
A lot of people would prefer to have distance, I think, mm-hmm. from the people who listen to them. It's interesting mm-hmm. to me that you seek out your listeners.
Yeah, I used to call myself the world's greatest living room entertainer. You know, I would sing for my supper or anything like that.
Okay. Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry Gross. It was a pleasure.
Bob DeRoe's new album is called Scabadabba. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What do you have for us on today's show?
We have a profile of Judge Robert Bork, President Reagan's choice to fill the Supreme Court seat vacated by the retirement of Justice Lewis Powell. The battle over Judge Bork's nomination will be fought along ideological lines. Is he an extremist or a thoughtful conservative? Tonight, a look at those views. Also, Fred Barbash on how the creators of the Constitution viewed Supreme Court judges. They agreed that the judges should be powerful and appointed for life, but they disagreed on whether the president or the Congress should do the choosing. And finally, we have childhood memories of summertime and of hiding places.
Okay, well, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Each week, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg joins us with his comments on language and culture. Today, he answers a question that he's been asked perhaps more frequently than any other. What does a linguist actually do?
Here's an item you might have missed in your local papers. Something close to 1,000 linguists have descended on Stanford University for the annual Summer Institute of the Linguistic Society of America. This is a 6-week marathon of courses, conferences, and all-night poker games. The atmosphere can get a bit intense, because most of these people spend the rest of the year sequestered in small groups at a handful of academic institutions and research centers, where they are surrounded by colleagues, wives, and husbands who don't understand them. Of course, you'd see pretty much the same kind of frenzied communion if you dropped in on the meetings of any other technical specialists, the paleontologists, the radio astronomers, or whatever. But there's at least one difference. Those subjects are supposed to be obscure. When somebody asks you what you do and you tell him you're an invertebrate embryologist, he is not about to start up with you. Whereas even if people aren't exactly sure what linguistics is, it sounds like the sort of thing they might be interested in. So linguists can't get off the hook the way a paleontologist can. We have to explain ourselves. It gets to be almost a litany. You tell somebody you're a linguist, and they ask you how many languages you speak. And then you have to say, well, no, that's what we call a polyglot. Linguists are people who study language in the abstract.
Then people take on a kind of hopeful expression and they say, oh, you mean like the origins of words. I think that's fascinating. And then you have to say, well, no, it's not so much that. I mean, most linguists have a recreational interest in that sort of thing, but they're really concerned with the underlying structure of language systems. By this time, you're starting to feel like a pedant, and they're starting to look a little vexed. How could a field that studies something as ordinary as human language turn out to be so obscure? Is this all a great shock? Well, no. But to see why linguistics is such an arcane discipline, you have to understand a basic property, some people would say the basic property, of human language. Language is so pervasive, and we learn it so early on, that it is largely invisible to us. We see through it without seeing it at all, unless we make a deliberate effort to bring the panes of the window into focus. One way to come to understand this is to imagine yourself trying to teach your native language to a foreigner. On day one, let's say, your student learns the house is big and the house is red, and then his eyes light up and he says, ah, is a red big house. So you correct him. You tell him, no, we say a big red house. It sounds funny the other way. But just why does it sound funny? If you're a dutiful teacher, you'll sit down that night and try to figure out the rule for English adjective order, a rule you learned long before you were out of diapers. Why do we say an old brass bed rather than a brass old bed or some other thing? Is it the sound of the words, or is it their meaning? Or is it something else? I'll leave it for you to puzzle out, but here's a hint. Of the two adjectives in old brass bed, which one is more like a noun? This is the sort of thing that linguists spend their time puzzling over, the rules of language that are so basic that no normal person would bother to give them any thought. Now, it's a good thing there are people doing this. Linguistics has important applications for everything from language instruction to artificial intelligence. But to be quite honest, it can also make for some frustrating conversation, knowing that your interlocutor may stop you at any point to remark on a particularly interesting vowel or an unusual use of the present perfect. On reflection, maybe it's just as well that there are so few of us and that we are let out only once a year.
Jeffrey Nunberg is indeed a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. His fields of expertise are semantics and sociolinguistics. Here's a preview of tomorrow's program. On our next show, I'll speak with lawyer and writer Scott Turow about his dual career. His new novel is a courtroom thriller titled Presumed Innocent. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new album by blues and soul singer Ted Hawkins. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review La Bamba, based on the life of rock and roller Ritchie Valens. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show is produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Lisa Bruton. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.